From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Within hours, President Trump is expected to start the process of pulling the U.S. out of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal that was negotiated during the Obama administration. The New York Times is reporting the president has already called French President Macron with the news. The 2015 deal put limits on Iran's nuclear program, destroying some of it. It sent fuel out of the country, dismantled centrifuges, installed inspections, all to prevent the country from producing a bomb. In exchange, the U.S., Britain, France, China, Russia, and Germany lifted sanctions that had been imposed for years. So, for instance, companies like Boeing could again sell planes to Iran. Trump has called the deal the worst deal ever. Senior officials from Britain, France, and Germany meeting in Brussels today stood by it. They say it's working, Iran has not violated it, and there's no plan B. NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman starts us off. Michelle, the next periodic deadline for an American president to approve these congressional sanctions is this Saturday. The president renewed them months ago. Again, it's thought he will not this time. What will you be listening for at 2 p.m. East Coast time?
Well, mostly, Robin, whether or not there's a real strategy here. You know, the European leaders, including Macron, who you mentioned, have come to town one by one, trying to convince Trump to stay in this deal and build up around it, you know, to deal with his other concerns, which were not covered by it. So what the Europeans were offering is let's keep it in place and work together to push back on Iran's other bad behavior in the region, its missile program, and to make a plan for what comes next when some of the restrictions are phased out over time. But Trump, it seems, isn't buying any of that. He wants to knock over the main pillar of this strategy and start over. But what I've been hearing is he hasn't really explained to U.S. allies how that's going to work.
And so what are some of the things you're looking for him to say today? I mean, for instance, we know that Trump and many of his supporters on this have said that the deal allows money to flow into Iran, which Iran then uses to support groups like Hamas and Hezbollah and support, for instance, the Syrian regime. What do you expect him to speak of that or simply to speak of the sanctions?
Well, that's something that he often talks about, and it's a question a lot of people in Congress are raising, too. You know, just this morning, the Republican chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Ed Royce, was chairing a hearing on Iran policy, and he said tearing up the nuclear deal is not going to recover the cash that was sent out to Iran under the deal. He says that toothpaste isn't going back in the tube. That was his quote. He also said he doesn't think it's going to galvanize allies into addressing Iran's dangerous activities in the region. He said withdrawing could push back those efforts, and he said Congress hasn't heard enough about an alternative strategy here. And this is a Congress that wasn't very supportive of this Iran nuclear deal to begin with.
Well, then there's the practical nature of this. You spoke with the former Treasury Department sanctions expert, Elizabeth Rosenberg, who told you, this expected decision is likely going to set off a scramble among workers at the Treasury Department to implement the sanctions.
He's not giving them any private lead time to prepare this guidance, which is going to take, in a best-case scenario, at least a couple of months to do. So the rest of the world will be confused, and the markets will respond accordingly, trying to figure out what this means and for whom.
Michelle, we're hearing from others that, for instance, the president might have to say, well, Boeing selling planes to Iran, can't do that anymore. But Airbus in France can. I mean, how does this get navigated? What else did she say to you?
Well, it's a very complicated thing. I mean, she was told me that when the original sanctions went into place, the Obama administration spent a lot of time explaining to allies what exactly it means. The ones, for instance, you know, there are a lot of sanctions on Iran. And every few months, the president has to waive them. The ones that are coming up this week are on the Central Bank of Iran, and they had been used to force countries to limit the amount of oil they buy from Iran, purchases that go through the Central Bank. And what the Obama administration did was it gave countries time to cut back on their purchases, 180 days, and they set a limit. If you cut back 20%, then you won't face sanctions. And, you know, you have to really explain to countries what they can and can't do, because they're not going to want to run afoul of U.S. laws. But they also, you know, under this deal, Iran you know, legitimate business is supposed to be allowed with Iran.
So you're hearing, it sounds like, a lot of confusion from diplomats from these countries. This is your, you know, this is your wheelhouse. Are there any supporting this?
Well, I mean, certainly all the people that were, you know, negotiated this don't support it. There is a school of thought that, you know, putting this amount of pressure back will get Iran back to the negotiating table to get a better deal. There are very few people who are saying that, certainly not the signatories of the deal. And let's not forget, it wasn't just Europe, but also China and Russia.
Yeah. Michelle Kellerman, NPR diplomatic correspondent, ahead of President Trump's expected announcement at 2 p.m. East Coast time, pulling the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal. Michelle, thank you.
Thank you.
And joining us now for more on the Iran deal is retired Admiral James Stavridis, Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University and former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. Admiral Stavridis, welcome back.
It's great to be on the program with you.
And do you think the president is going to pull out of this Iran deal?
I think the president is unpredictable, but I'd say there's an 80% chance that he will pull out of the deal, maybe a 20% chance that he'll stay in it in a way that puts the pressure on the Europeans to try and cut a new deal. But I think the odds are he's going to pull out.
And what are the consequences of that in your view?
Three big bad things. One is it will put even more tension into the Middle East, which is already a powder keg between Iranian Shias and Saudi Sunnis and the State of Israel. Number two, it will have a knock-on effect and a bad one on the Korean negotiations. Why would Kim Jong-un want to sign up with us if we are perceived as unreliable? And here's the worst thing of all. It drives a huge wedge between the United States and our European allies. That's a big mistake. So I would counseled the president to remain in the deal.
Well, let's start with the Korean issue. Why would the president do that, given that he's so close now to a potential summit with Kim Jong-un?
There's no logic to it. I think he has compartmented these two issues. And I think the problem for the Iranian side is he is obsessed with undoing the legacy of Barack Obama, and he's allowing his tendencies in that direction to overcome the common sense argument that he should not do this. So there's no logical explanation.
How do you think Iran would react?
I think Iran will first pause and see what the Europeans are going to do. Will the Europeans follow the lead of the United States? I, for one, do not think they will. And thus, I could construct a world in which the European allies continue to do business with Iran. In that case, Iran may continue to follow the terms of the deal. But back to paragraph three about the wedge between the United States and the Europeans, that would be dramatically bad.
And in the region, you use the term powder keg. Explain what you mean. What do you think would happen?
I think that Iran would be emboldened if they do come out from under the deal. Let's say the Europeans side with the United States. Now the deal is broken. Iran has already, by the way, received the billions of dollars that were frozen. So they're, in that sense, winners in this episode. And they'll continue with no constraints and no reason to follow, if you will, norms of international law. They will push even harder in their campaigns in Yemen, in Syria, in Iraq, in Lebanon, because there really is no motivation for them. There are no guardrails on them anymore.
Israel clearly wants President Trump to pull out of the deal. How big of an impact do you think Prime Minister Netanyahu's big speech in front of a TV with, you know, like a PowerPoint presentation, did that have an impact, do you think?
I think it perhaps had an impact on the president, who tends to respond well to visual stimuli. I don't think it had much impact internationally. It certainly didn't sway anybody else. What's really driving the train at the moment is John Bolton, the new national security advisor, who has deep antipathy for Iran. I think new Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is on the hawkish side of this thing. I think Vice President Pence is as well. I think Secretary Mattis would prefer to see the deal stay, but he'll toe the party line. So the odds are, again, that you'll see the president pull out of this deal.
Now, you've mentioned the relationship between the U.S. and Europe. You, of course, were the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. What do you think are the consequences for the U.S.-European, the U.S.-NATO relationship if the president pulls out?
It will put a great deal of stress on the transatlantic bridge, if you will. I mean, this is a very fundamental diversion between the fundamental interests of the European Union, who is a participant in this, along with individually France, the United Kingdom, and Germany, and the United States on the other side. And particularly, here's the real problem. If the Europeans stay in the deal and continue to do business with Iran, they become liable to U.S. sanctions, any of their companies that do so. That's a tricky knot to untie. I'm not sure there's a good way to do that, and it's going to really polarize Europe and the United States and therefore the NATO alliance.
That's Admiral James Stavridis, Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University and former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. Admiral Stavridis, thanks so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure to be on NPR. Thank you.
Today, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office announced it's investigating those allegations that surfaced yesterday that New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman physically abused four women. Schneiderman resigned after the women's allegations were published in a story in The New Yorker. And this comes just a week after Schneiderman was honored by the National Institute for Reproductive Health as a champion of choice.
If a woman does not have the right to control her own body, she is not truly equal.
Bob Hart is political director at New York One. He joins us from the newsroom there. And Bob, this must have been a bombshell. You have a Democrat, someone who was seen as a champion of women's rights, sworn to uphold their protection.
It was a Me Too steamroller. This all unfolded in about 3 hours, from about 6:55 p.m. last night when The New Yorker put out its devastating report about Eric Schneiderman, to less than 3 hours later when Schneiderman was announcing his resignation, still sort of denying the claims in this article, but realizing that after the governor said he had to step down, that he was going to do so, that he could no longer hold office as the state's highest law enforcement official.
This is Governor Cuomo. And by the way, Schneiderman is denying assaulting anyone. He says he engaged in role-playing and other consensual sexual activity. But the allegations are pretty lurid. So if you could just briefly lay them out.
Yes, four women who had relationships with Schneiderman told The New Yorker, they said that he became abusive toward them, physically abusive, that he drank heavily, and then he would abuse them. He'd verbally abuse them and then physically abuse them. On top of that, according to one of the women, he told them, "I am the law." Mm-hmm. So they were terrified. First of all, I think there was the guilt factor, the victim blaming herself. And then on top of that, this wasn't just some random perpetrator. This was one of the most powerful men in New York State.
Yeah. Again, these are allegations, but that he slapped, choked the women, and then, as you say, allegations that he used his position as well. Look, this is happening during election year. Schneiderman was running for re-election, was considered the heir apparent in the AG's race. Remind us why, first of all. What were some of the cases that he's taken on?
Schneiderman really took a national leading role as the legal counterbalance to Donald Trump. Even before Donald Trump was president, Schneiderman was pressing forward on this class action, helping the plaintiffs in the class action lawsuit against Trump University. So he was a thorn in Donald Trump's side before Trump got into office. And then afterwards, he was definitely on the forefront of a variety of issues, including sanctuary cities and the undocumented immigrants, DACA, better known as, for the children who were brought here by parents who were here illegally. And he really wanted to become a sort of a national figurehead. And the president was still tweeting about him. And the president's son was sort of having a victory lap of sorts last night on Twitter, pointing out that Donald Trump was mixing it up with Eric Schneiderman on Twitter about 5 years ago.
And that continues crowing on social media from people who do support Donald Trump and are seeing Schneiderman, at least for the moment, taken down. Look, he also filed the lawsuit against Harvey Weinstein following the investigation into allegations of sexual misconduct. Who takes that over now?
Well, we sort of have a Me Too Mobius strip going on in New York. As you noted earlier, the Manhattan District Attorney said he's going to be investigating these allegations against Schneiderman. Schneiderman was investigating the Manhattan District Attorney, Cy Vance, to see whether or not he had done enough in the Harvey Weinstein case. So Governor Cuomo this morning was talking about perhaps another district attorney besides Vance coming in and looking at these allegations against Schneiderman, because Schneiderman could say, listen, Cy Vance, you have a chip on your shoulder, you have an axe to grind, of course you're going to investigate me. So I wouldn't be surprised if the Manhattan District Attorney was no longer part of this investigation and someone else stepped in to look at these women's allegations.
This is just,
it's really amazing, kind of a pretzel going on right now in New York.
Amazing. And we remember these were earlier allegations against Harvey Weinstein by a model who said that she was propositioned. She had videotape, and it wasn't followed up.
Correct. There was a lot of questions as to why the Manhattan District Attorney's Office didn't follow through on the Weinstein accusations. Cy Vance, the Manhattan DA, explained blow by blow as much as he could why he didn't. But in the wake of more allegations coming out against Weinstein, I think there's a lot of second guessing going on. Did Vance do enough? So the governor directed Schneiderman, before all these allegations came forward, directed Schneiderman to look into the Weinstein case and possibly reopen it. Of course, now someone else in the Attorney General's office is going to have to do that. It's a woman who's the state solicitor general, at least for now.
Well, look, back to how this is landing in New York. I mean, there must be some conversations about how, you know, it doesn't matter political stripe. These kinds of accusations will take down anyone in this moment.
We've had it already in New York long before Me Too was a hashtag. We had our governor, Elliot Spitzer, resign in a prostitution scandal. In a non-Me Too moment, our state comptroller resigned because his driver was being improperly used to do chores and chauffeur around his wife. About 20 years ago, 25 years ago, the state's top judge had to step down in a scandal in which he was stalking his ex-mistress. So New York really has a whole series of kind of Me Too scandals the last 25 years.
You left out Anthony Weiner.
Yes, and we, of course, Anthony Weiner, who congressman who tried twice to run for mayor unsuccessfully, now in prison for sending lewd pictures of himself to an underage girl.
Quite a story there. Bob Hart, political director at New York One, on the resignation of New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman after allegations that he physically abused four women. Bob, thank you.
Thanks very much. Our heads are still spinning here in the newsroom.
Well, last week we brought you a story about how rice farmers in California are flooding parts of their fields to create habitat for migrating birds. Today, a story about how farmers along the Sacramento River are working with scientists to help boost dwindling salmon populations. They're doing it by trying something a little different, growing bugs as food for fish. Capital Public Radio's Ezra David Romero reports.
Jacob Katz is on the hunt, but not for geese or ducks on this rice farm about 40 minutes north of Sacramento. With an aquarium net in hand, he's on the lookout for bugs.
So we're good bug hunting. You can see that this water is just slightly turbid. There's a little bit of wind. Dip this net into the water, and it just comes out literally full of bugs.
Katz is a scientist with California Trout, a conservation group with a focus on protecting wild fish.
Wow. These are mostly cladocerans. We call them water fleas.
We're at River Garden Farms, founded in 1913. They grow things like corn, wheat, and a lot of rice. The 15,000-acre farm has partnered with California Trout and UC Davis on a pilot project to create what they call floodplain fatties, a nickname for the well-fed baby salmon and smelt who will eat their bugs in the Sacramento River.
These little bugs are floating fillet for salmon that will be in the river.
The reason they're doing this? Young Chinook salmon and other fish need help. Much of the water they need to survive is now stored in dams and diverted through thousands of miles of levees. The project's in year two, and the end goal is to improve the likelihood that salmon survive the trek to the ocean and back.
What farmers are doing is reconnecting that floodplain natural wealth to the river system where it's needed. More fish equals a win-win for everybody. It means that we have a system that works for people and for the environment.
We're creating fish food. It's very simple.
Roger Cornwell with River Garden Farms says it all starts with rice paddies. As general manager, he's used to flooding fields during the off-season to provide a rest stop for millions of birds along the Pacific Flyway. Now, instead of just letting the water soak into the earth, he's made a change that mimics the natural floodplain of the Sacramento River.
We just pump the water in, let it slow down, and it starts to break down the carbon that's there, creates algae. Algae create bugs. Then we pump that right back to the river to feed the fish.
So far, 12 farmers are growing bugs on about 50,000 acres in the Sacramento area. That's about 70 pounds of bugs per acre foot of water. The group is figuring out the details about exactly how to get that fish food back into the river on a large scale. They hope to ramp up the project with as many rice farms as possible in years to come. But Cornwell says they still need to work out some kinks.
I think for the farmer, it's more of how effectively can we get food to the fish? We've got to have all the processes figured out to make it easy for everybody to implement.
Carson Jeffries is an aquatic biologist with UC Davis. He and Jacob Katz published a study last year that suggests that when farmers and conservationists work together, there could be more fish. He says this project eliminates the popular farms versus fish argument.
It's through that relationship with the farmers that we have the most potential for future success, as opposed to standing with our heads in the sand. This is getting us to a place where we can actually have real impacts and change over time.
Back on the rice farm, Roger Cornwell is about to release the bug-rich water into the Sacramento River through a system of pumps and canals.
This water's been out here for right at 3 weeks right now, and so we'll let some out now.
For Cornwell, who's farmed in the region for over a decade, the Science Farm partnership cost him about $45 per acre.
We're stepping out of our comfort zone. As this grows, people will see what we're doing, and then we can start developing trust among neighbors, and then this program is just going to take off on its own.
He says the minimal cost is worth it to save fish and to make sure the acreage is around for future generations. For Here and Now, I'm Ezra David Romero.
Let's get more on our top story, President Trump's decision on the Iran deal. Joining us now is the BBC's Jenny Hill in Berlin. Jenny, what's the expectation there in Europe about what the president is going to do?
Well, I think there's a degree of pessimism here, a real sense of concern that President Trump is going to be true to his word and just walk away from this deal. There has been a lot of effort behind the scenes and more publicly from the German end of things going into persuading him to changing his mind. You'll perhaps be aware that Angela Merkel made a trip to Washington recently. She did that along with, although they were separate trips, Emmanuel Macron of France. The two leaders had prepared, coordinated their delegations to President Trump. Right up on their agendas was, of course, this Iran deal, trying to get across to the president how important it is in the eyes of Europe.
And, of course, the British foreign secretary was in the United States doing interviews about why he thinks the U.S. should stay in the deal as well. Do you think that Germany, France, and the U.K. would continue to honor the agreement if the U.S. pulls out?
It's hard to speculate, of course, at this point in time, because we don't know what President Trump's going to say. But certainly take fairly influential figures like Wolfgang Ischinger, who's the head of the Munich Security Conference. He has already publicly said, look, you know, if Trump walks away, then it's very important that Britain, Germany, France should get back to the table with Iran and see if they can't try and somehow hold this together. Easier said, of course, than done. But let's wait and see what the details are. There is still, of course, the hope here in Berlin that President Trump might renege on what he's been saying, might come out with something that's softer, might, for example, say, well, let's start phasing in sanctions gradually. There may be some wiggle room. And as you know, Angela Merkel's very good at trying to negotiate compromises. If there is some wiggle room, she, along with France and Britain, I'm sure, will be getting in there as quickly as they can to try and save what she has actually described herself as an imperfect deal. But as she has said, an imperfect deal is better than no deal.
What does it say, bigger picture, about European clout that if Trump does pull out, that the leaders of Germany, France, and the UK could not convince him to stay in.
I think certainly here in Berlin behind the scenes, there is real resignation that Europe's relationship with the US is not going to be in a good place while the president is Donald Trump. Angela Merkel, I think, is taking a pragmatic approach. They know, the people who are advising her, that it's no good going to Donald Trump and lecturing him or trying to persuade him. We know that we've seen Angela Merkel, for example, try to appeal to his business sense mm-hmm. on other issues. So she's trying, but I think, as I say, there isn't a great deal of optimism that miracles can be worked for the relationship between America and the EU. We know, of course, that Donald Trump doesn't seem to see the EU as a particularly important institution.
Have the Germans been doing a lot of business with Iran since the sanctions were lifted?
One of the reasons Germany is such a big ally for Iran in Europe is the economic reason. Since 2016, German-Iranian trade increased by 42%. In fact, Germany is, I think, Iran's third largest trading partner. Yeah. Chemicals, machinery, cars and so on go backwards and forwards. So it is big business for Germany, although the industry representatives here would say, actually, since the sanctions were lifted, since this deal came into place, we have been rather disappointed. There has been an increase in trade, but it's not what it could be, and that, they say, is because of the noises coming out of the States.
That's the BBC's Jenny Hill joining us from Berlin. Jenny, thank you.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to join you.
So President Trump is expected to announce at around 2 p.m. East Coast time that he will begin withdrawing the U.S. from the Iran nuclear deal. And when he does, the Middle East will be watching closely. Some leaders in the region have said U.S. withdrawal could cause a massive arms buildup. But Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu gave that talk last week, claiming the Iranians are lying about keeping to the deal, a direct threat to Israel's existence. Let's bring in Borzu Daragahi, Middle East correspondent based in Turkey and longtime contributor to Here and Now. He joins us from Istanbul. Hi, Borzu.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. And you're going to be with us as we report on the president's announcement when it comes at 2 p.m. But it's already ricocheting around that the New York Times is reporting that the president has already called French President Macron and told him the U.S. will pull out, will reinstate sanctions. Just give us a sense of how countries are reacting. Start with Jordan, for instance.
Well, the Jordanians, as with other countries in the region, are nervous about this. They saw the nuclear deal as a way of at least resolving one of the issues that was causing a lot of tension in the region. But I think that everyone's going to be watching closely. As with everything, the devil is in the details. The headline that you gave, the U.S. pulls out of the deal, is that really what the U.S. is going to do? There's a number of things that it can do. One suggestion is that it could say that it's going to reimpose sanctions, but on a deferred basis. It could say that it's not going to waive sanctions anymore, but it remains in the deal and wants to negotiate a better deal. There'll be weeks, possibly months of negotiation afterwards. I don't think this is going to be a, you know, sudden cataclysmic event. It's going to play out over weeks in the corridors of power throughout the region.
Yeah. Well, the Jordanian foreign minister warned today, as he has been, of dangerous repercussions and an arms race in the Middle East unless a political solution is found to reduce nuclear weapons. The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia told CBS News last March that his kingdom would without a doubt develop nuclear weapons if Iran, you know, an arch enemy, were to do so because the deal was broken. So most people are talking about security, but what are other issues? Are there economic issues, much as some of the countries in the deal are facing, those who, you know, were doing business with Iran because of the lifted sanctions?
Well, I mean, you have the United Arab Emirates, Dubai specifically, which is Iran's largest or second largest trading partner, along with China. And they had that status during the time of intense sanctions against Iran as well. But none of the other Middle East countries really abide by sanctions. Turkey, for example, does robust trading with Iran, pretty much ignored the sanctions, somewhat to its peril, during the previous years before the nuclear deal was made. Really, the countries that are key in terms of what is going to happen with the nuclear deal. Are the European countries, Russia and China, will also likely ignore anything the U.S. does at this point?
Yeah, and we read that Israel, the security forces there, are already on high alert along the northern border with Syria. Anticipating today's announcement, we had Netanyahu do that sort of TED talk where he laid out past lying by Iran to show that it is lying now, even though, you know, every inspector, every agency feels that Iran is holding to the deal. What's the sentiment inside Israel about the U.S. pulling out?
Well, Israelis are very nervous about Iran. I think the security establishment, it was supportive of the nuclear deal, even people who were skeptics in the beginning. Now that they see that Iran is abiding by the terms of the deal, they're supporting. Even some of the people in Netanyahu's own security trust are supportive of the deal. But Netanyahu seems to have a very instinctive, visceral opposition to the deal. He has from the beginning. He's been opposed to it vociferously. And, he's going to be victorious at this point. This is something that he's wanted. I have a feeling that Netanyahu feels like this deal gave people a false sense of comfort about Iran, and he doesn't want that sense of comfort around. He wants worries about Iran to be as high in the rest of the world as it is among his inner circle in Israel.
Okay, well, we will see what happens again at 2 p.m. East Coast time here in the United States. President Trump expected, and it's been reported, he's already called the French president to say that he will begin pulling the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal. As Borhu Daragahi points out, that could come in many shapes, and he'll be back with us. Borhu, thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Meanwhile, there's lots going on already here in the United States where it's primary day. In four states, voters offering a preview of what's to come in the general election later this year. Voters in Ohio will also have a chance to change the way the state draws congressional maps. Ohio has some of the most gerrymandered congressional districts in the country. Out of 16 district maps in Ohio, 12 are drawn to favor Republicans. Issue 1 on Ohio's ballot today would require more bipartisanship in the line-drawing process. Nick Castell of WCPN IdeaStream has this report.
It takes a majority of the Ohio legislature to pass a map, and that means the party in power has a lot of say over how it looks. For decades, there have been attempts to shake up this process.
Millions of dollars were spent on both sides. Countless redistricting reformers were engaged in those efforts, and we came to naught.
Catherine Terser with Common Cause Ohio hopes this year is different. Her group advocates for redistricting reform and more disclosure in campaign finance. Common Cause, the League of Women Voters, and others gathered petition signatures to put a new plan on the ballot. The state legislature drew up its own ideas. In February, the two sides negotiated a deal. For a time, Terser says, it did not seem like they were going to get there.
So I do feel like it's a minor miracle that Democrats and Republicans came together and came up with redistricting reform.
What they agreed to does not dictate the party makeup of each district, but it does reconfigure the process for drawing the lines. The Ohio Secretary of State's office produced a video explaining the basics.
Under Issue 1, the Ohio General Assembly or the Ohio Redistricting Commission would draw the new map.
The map would need 3/5 support in both the state House and Senate, and it has to be bipartisan, with at least half of the two major parties backing it. If the General Assembly can't meet that bar by the end of September 2021, the 7-member redistricting commission has a chance to draw a bipartisan map. If they can't do it, the legislature gets another shot.
If a proposed map does not receive bipartisan support, it must still pass with a simple majority vote, but will only be valid for 4 years.
And if the legislature passes a map with a simple majority, it's got to abide by some rules. For instance, the map can't be drawn to unduly favor one party or its incumbents.
There are currently no guidelines or rules other than federal law or federal judicial decisions. So this is an opportunity for Ohio to clarify the process.
Republican State Senator Matt Huffman co-sponsored this proposal in the legislature. He says the plan aims to keep communities together, too.
There are restrictive rules in terms of how many times that counties and other local jurisdictions can be divided, and we restrict the elongation of districts.
Districts must be compact, and 65 out of Ohio's 88 counties cannot be split up. Michael Lee, the senior redistricting counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University Law School, says Ohio's proposal is a strong one.
It has stronger rules on what the legislature can do. It also requires bipartisan support, at least in the first two steps, to get a map passed.
Lee adds that Ohio stands out compared with other states where legislatures have resisted change.
Ohio has been unusual in the sense that the legislature is actually willing to entertain serious and meaningful reforms.
The plan has support from both the Republican and the Democrat running for Ohio Secretary.